This holiday season, comfort means slowing down and finding calm amid the chaos. Create your natural oasis by prioritizing rest, comfort, and connection with Avocado Green Mattress. As the holidays fill up with gatherings and to-do lists, Avocado mattresses and home essentials provide the foundation for deeper rest, calmer mornings, and a healthier daily routine. Every product is thoughtfully made with the planet in mind, so you can feel good about the comfort and quality you bring into your home. Avocado is better for you and better for the planet. And to make your purchase more accessible, you'll have easy financing options with Affirm. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's find a conversation between the soul and the night.
What my international affairs news. Derek, I don't know if you've heard, but MTV is ceasing broadcasting in December. So I thought I should do a little tribute to that.
Ceasing completely?
Yeah, ceasing completely. Going to go to static video. Wow. I guess, what is it? Wow. TikTok killed the video star. End of an era, baby. Jesus. End of an era. But I didn't do my normal thing.
What were they even doing now? It was just like real world reruns all the time or something, was it? I mean, like, yeah.
I haven't watched it in quite a while, but the end of an
time
era,
marches on.
Gen X, your beautiful Gen X generation, Derek, Jesus, will never receive its due.
Nothing probably, left. We're never going to get to have a president.
I was going
to
say, probably won't have a president. Culture Kamala was your
has been taken away. Like it's yeah, we're going to disappear completely.
Finally, memory. Well, good riddance. Well, hello, prestige heads. Welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner. Here, as always, is my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. Sorry about starting off with that depressing reminder that time marches on. But let's start with Trump's Asia trip. Derek, Trump is a deals man. He's a deals boy. He's a deals gentleman. He made many deals on this trip. Let's talk about these trade deals.
Many deals. Trump was in Asia ostensibly to attend two summits. He attended the Association of Southeast Asian Nations Summit in Kuala Lumpur. He was supposed to attend the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in South Korea. We can get to that. He didn't actually wind up attending that one, but he was there ostensibly to do these two summits and to meet with various regional leaders, as one does on the sidelines of these things, and do deals. And so, yeah, he did a number of deals. He completed or concluded trade deals with while he was in Kuala Lumpur with the Malaysian government, with the Cambodian government. He also concluded what they're calling framework arrangements with the Thai government, the Vietnamese government. The basic outline here, and I don't want to go into all the details because some of them are absurd and never going to come to pass, and others are relatively minor. But the basic framework seems to be that the U.S. has agreed to exemptions of certain products from these countries, from the so-called reciprocal tariff regime, and those countries agree to reduce tariffs on U.S. products and commit to some degree of purchases. And this is where some of the numbers get absurd, and it's, you know, not worth really going into all the details. But the chief products that he seems to be hawking during this trip are Boeing aircraft and agricultural products. Agricultural products obviously playing to part of his base. So he did those deals in Malaysia. He then made a side trip to Japan where he met with Takeuchi Sanai, the new prime minister of Japan. They seemed to hit it off pretty well. There was that heartwarming scene you might have seen shared on social video where at the reception for Trump, where he just kept kind of wandering off, just kind of kept wandering off, like he didn't really know where he was or what he was doing, and Takeuchi would kind of, you know, grab his arm and direct him around, and it was very nice, like an older person and their caregiver. It's always nice to see that sort of thing. They agreed to a deal that mostly I think covered critical minerals. I don't know the extent to which Japan has any critical minerals to really offer the U.S. or in what shape they are. But there was a critical minerals seems to have been the main component of that deal. Then he went off to South Korea, where, as I say, he was supposed to attend the Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. He did a deal with the South Korean government, which reduced tariffs on that country's vehicles and car parts to 15%. They had been at 25%. This put South Korea on parity with what Trump had already agreed to with Japan. There's this $350 billion in investments that the South Korean government's supposed to make in the U.S. economy over a period of, I think, 10 years. They kind of refined that a little bit so it wouldn't be such a huge chunk of cash. I think it's only now $200 billion that South Korea has to directly invest, which, again, is still fairly absurd in the U.S. economy. And then there's another, the other $150 billion will come with South Korea helping to re-energize the U.S. shipbuilding sector, which is a big deal for Trump. He did not meet with Kim Jong-un. He had talked about this before the trip and even during the trip, kind of musing to reporters that he would like to meet with Kim Jong-un during this this little excursion. There's no indication that Kim Jong-un wanted to meet with him, and no preparations had been made, so it seemed unlikely this was going to happen, and in fact, it did not happen. The big headline, of course, of the South Korean leg of the tour was Trump's summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping, which we can get into as well.
Let's get into that in a second. I just want to make a quick correction. Apparently, MTV is only shutting down in Europe, even though I read an article.
Okay. All right.
I read an article that suggested the U.S., but I might have over-interpreted. So sorry, listeners. You only come to American Prestige for full facts. So apologies. And Derek, you know what I always think of with the U.S.? Yes, go.
What was MTV? MTV is like in Paramount, right? Weren't they part of the David Ellison Failson purchase? So that's all upheaval.
Yeah,
so maybe they'll still get shut down. Whatever happened to VH1?
I have no idea. Okay. Much Music, right. VH1, MTV, all the classics. And another thing is, whenever I think of U.S.-Japan relations, do you remember when George H.W. Bush vomited and passed out on the Japanese prime minister? For all you Zoomers out there, check out, there's a video of it, I believe.
I've seen video of it.
Parodied, of course, in Top Gun. Not Top Gun, Hot Shots Part 2.
No, Hot Shots Part 2.
Yeah, classic, another classic. So Zoomers out there, check out Hot Shots and Hot Shots Part 2, classic movies. All right, Derek, we are going to talk about the Xi Summit. Do you want to talk about that first or the Thai-Cambodia Accord?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we should, I guess, talk about briefly the Thai-Cambodia Accord. Right. This was the first order of business in Kuala Lumpur. The Thailand and Cambodia signed a formal ceasefire, kind of codifying the ceasefire that they agreed to earlier this year that ended their little cross-border skirmishes that took place back in July. Trump, of course, has claimed responsibility for negotiating a ceasefire alongside the Prime Minister of Malaysia, Anwar Ibrahim. And he was there for the signing ceremony. I'm still not clear. This is supposedly this document that they signed, the four of them, it was the leaders of Thailand and Cambodia, as well as Anwar and Trump, all signed this thing. It's supposed to build on the ceasefire, the sort of more informal, I guess, ceasefire that they had agreed to earlier this year. It's not clear to me how in any way that it actually expands on that ceasefire. What it does seem to have been was the price of getting Trump to show up at the summit was he wanted to have a big, fancy ceasefire signing ceremony. I guess reiterate that he got screwed out of the Nobel Peace Prize and, make a big deal out of that. So I would hesitate to say this was entirely for show because I don't know that for sure, but that does seem to have been a big component, of this signing was just, it was the thing that was going to get Trump to turn up at the summit.
All right. Let's talk about the big news, which is his meeting with Xi.
Right. So Trump met with Xi, again, on the sidelines, sort of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. This had been in the planning for weeks, although there was a brief dust-up a couple of weeks ago after China imposed new rare earth restrictions, and Trump said he wasn't sure that it made sense to meet with Xi at all at that point. They managed to put that behind each other, or behind themselves, and sent delegations to Malaysia, who met for a couple of days, Friday through Sunday, at which point they announced that they had reached a framework, again, another one of these framework agreements that was waiting for Trump and Xi to meet on Thursday in South Korea to finalize it. The big headlines here are a reduction, apparently, in U.S. tariffs on Chinese products, a suspension of those rare earth or critical mineral trade restrictions by China for at least a year. That suspension could be extended, or there could be, you know, another arrangement reached over that period of time. An immediate, according to Trump, increase in Chinese purchases of U.S. agricultural products, in particular soybeans. China had stopped buying U.S. soybeans, which was a huge deal for the U.S. soybean market. Had stopped buying them because of the trade war. So should be an immediate boost to soybean farmers in the U.S. And the sale or transfer, whatever they're calling it, of TikTok from Chinese ownership to basically Larry Ellison and company, Trump's buddies, was apparently finalized. So those are the big elements of it. I'm sure there are more. This meeting happened on Thursday, and you know, all the details I think have not yet been released. Those are the ones I have seen. The tariff reduction, I think, is 10%. This is coming out of the fentanyl tariff that Trump imposed on Chinese products. They supposedly reached some kind of agreement on doing more to curb the trafficking of fentanyl and its precursor chemicals, though that's, again, a statement from Trump without any details to it. So it seems to have been a successful enough meeting. I mean, it'll last as long as, you know, Trump doesn't get mad at China again, which just seems to be a recurring theme of his second term as president. So, you know, give it a couple of months and we'll see where we are. The interesting thing, as I said in the beginning of this segment, is that he was supposed to attend the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit while he was in South Korea. After meeting with Xi, he just got on Air Force One and flew back to the U.S. So he didn't attend the summit. It's unclear whether that's going to have any effect on U.S. relations in the region. I would expect that it might, particularly if China, if she's going to be there, and this is still sort of a competition for, you know, getting countries on side, on one side or the other of the new Cold War. So that probably will not work in Trump's favor in that regard. But he doesn't like these things, and I guess he was tired and bored and wanted to go home. So he did.
Sounds like our man. All right. People have actually been asking for more on Sudan, and I guess I could drop this bomb that we are actually doing a series on Sudan that will hopefully be released sometime in the future. But Derek, let's talk this week about the RSF taking Al-Fashir and the massacres that have ensued as a result of that.
Yeah, the Rapid Support Forces militants have been besieging Al-Fashir, which is the capital of Sudan's North Darfur state, for about 18 months, a bit over 18 months, I believe, at this point. Over the weekend, they finally were able to enter the city and take it. There was video footage of the Sudanese military, which apparently negotiated a surrender of the city and a withdrawal of the, you know, pulling its assets out of Al-Fashir and the RSF moving in. The Sudanese military or the leader of Sudan's military government, I should say, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, later confirmed that the RSF had taken the city and the Sudanese had withdrawn, the military had withdrawn. There were immediate, almost immediate reports of massacres. And, you know, the background to this is the RSF, of course, has been credibly accused of crimes against humanity, genocidal acts in Darfur. Its historic roots are in the Janjaweed militia, which, you know, was the worst of the worst actors in the Darfur genocide in the early 2000s. And it's continued to just brutalize non-Arab communities in that region as it has advanced to what is basically now more or less uncontested control of all of Darfur. There's still a chunk of North Darfur state that's in the hands of armed factions that are aligned with the Sudanese military, but there's no city in that chunk of territory. There's no major population center. So, you know, really the all of the capitals, all of the state capitals and all the major towns and cities at this point, I think, you know, there may be one or two stragglers in North Darfur. But for all intents and purposes, the populated areas of the region are now all controlled by the RSF. You know, we've had reports throughout this conflict of massacres, of, you know, sexual assaults, of robberies, of, you know, kind of shaking people down, just you know, brutally treating these communities. And that's continued in the last couple of days in Al-Fashir. The Sudanese government has accused the RSF of killing upwards of 2,500 people just in the first couple of days. I think their total was 2,377. This aligns with reports from local, again, these local kind of armed factions that are aligned with the military, claimed that they had killed, the RSF had killed over 2,000 people. There's a report of them massacring 460 people just in the Saudi hospital, which was one of the two medical facilities in Al-Fashir that was still operating, again, after 18 months of siege. There have been claims of videos released, the RSF, like RSF fighters releasing their own videos showing them just gunning people down, summarily executing people. They've also, the group has also released videos of these staged events where they're doing things like giving candy to young children to try and change the narrative a little bit, but that doesn't seem to be working terribly well. The leader of the RSF, Mohammed Hamdan Dagalo, released a video address on Wednesday promising to investigate and punish any transgressions against human rights, etc. His track record does not inspire much confidence that he's going to actually do that. So that's where things stand. There's a lot of intensified concern that this is going to open the door to the partition of Sudan, you know, if not a formal partition, then at least a de facto partition, as the RSF kind of parks itself in Darfur and parts of most of the Kordofan region, which it also controls in the south. There doesn't seem to be much of an avenue at this point for the military to try and roll any of this back. So de facto partition may be where this is going to wind up. But we'll have to obviously have to wait and see about that. The possibility of that and of these communities that, again, have suffered greatly at the hands of the RSF just being under its control now without any sort of check or challenge is pretty disturbing. But again, who knows what the future will bring, I guess.
Derek, that's so beautiful. Who knows what the future will bring? Everyone,
well,
just really,
it's probably not anything good. Is it?
Take that in. Who knows what the future will bring? God. Speaking of who knows what the future will bring, let's move to Israel-Palestine, where we saw in the past week the deadliest day since the quote-unquote ceasefire, I mean, rapidly coming apart slash maybe never really existed ceasefire, began.
Yes. So starting Tuesday overnight into Wednesday, the IDF killed, the last figure I saw was 109 people and wounded 250 plus, according to the health ministry in Gaza. There were a couple of things that could be looked at as precursors here. The one that I think is most relevant is there was some sort of clash in Rafah. On Tuesday, kind of midday-ish on Tuesday, there were reports of gunfire and explosions in the Rafah area. And the Israelis then said that one IDF soldier had been killed, ostensibly by Hamas fighters. Hamas has denied any involvement in this incident, but it has in the past said that it's got elements of it, of the Qassam Brigades, its armed wing, that are in Rafah that have been out of contact with the main body of the group for months and may be just operating on their own impetus. So it is possible that there were Hamas personnel involved in this at some level, but it may not have been directed. The attack may not have been directed by the group's leadership. Nevertheless, this IDF soldier was apparently killed. and the bombing, the airstrikes resulted from that. There was another grievance that Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, was waving around on Tuesday. Apparently Hamas had repatriated partial remains of what they said was one of these still unidentified captives' bodies in Gaza. Those remains turned out to belong to a captive whose other remains had already been recovered by the Israelis a couple of years ago. So it was not, they were misidentified. Netanyahu treated this as a gross violation of the ceasefire rather than what you would think is the simpler explanation. This was just a mistake on the part of Hamas in a difficult situation, identifying these bodies in the rubble and the condition that they're probably in at this point, probably quite difficult. That said, the Israelis then released what they said was drone footage of Hamas staging the discovery, the quote unquote discovery of these remains. And who knows what the provenance of this video is? You're taking the Israeli government's word for it that this is what it shows. Nevertheless, if that's the case, then obviously the so-called misidentification takes on a little bit of a grimmer tone. So I suspect there was going to be some IDF action in Gaza Tuesday evening, maybe into Wednesday anyway. But the battle or skirmish or whatever it was in Rafah and the death of this Israeli soldier really sealed the deal and, you know, triggered this massive, as you said, most violent day, most violent 24-hour period, let's say, since the ceasefire went into effect. And you're right to say, you know, maybe it never went into effect. I mean, the Israelis on Wednesday, you know, kind of after they were done with the bombing campaign, declared that they would resume the ceasefire. They've never really adopted the ceasefire in the first place. They're still striking Gaza pretty much on a daily basis. So it's a little fanciful to say that they're resuming it. They never started in the first place. It is clear, again, as it became clear in Lebanon, as it's clear pretty much all these sorts of agreements, that the Israelis don't regard the ceasefire as something that they're obliged to honor. It's, again, you know, you cease, we fire is the macabre joke that gets told here. That seems to be the case here. In fact, to sort of hammer home the point, they announced on Wednesday that they were resuming the ceasefire. And then Wednesday afternoon, they attacked Gaza City again, killing at least one person. So, I mean, they're just continuing. And I believe there's been an attack on Thursday. I don't know the details of that, but they're just continuing to sort of strike Gaza pretty much every day. This particular day was just more intense than the others.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move on and let's talk about the PKK, which is the Kurdish party in Turkey. It just made another concession to the government. So what happened there?
Over the weekend, the PKK declared, the Kurdistan Workers Party, or PKK, declared that it's withdrawing its remaining fighters in Turkey to bases in northern Iraq. This is another part of the peace talks, the peace process that it's engaged in with the Turkish government. The ruling party in Turkey, the Justice and Development Party, made big deal of this announcement and, said it was proof that the negotiating effort that President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has started here with PKK is working. That said, I think what's notable here is that there were a number of PKK officials and Kurdish politicians in Turkey who made some somewhat cryptic but fairly clear to easy to understand statements around this announcement to the effect that this may be the last concession that the PKK makes unless the Turkish government does something to indicate that this is a two-way street, and it really hasn't done anything at this point. I think one prominent Kurdish politician in Turkey said, you know, this is the end of phase one of the ceasefire process. There were PKK officials who gave interviews that said, you know, we're really looking for Ankara to take some steps here to show, you know, what it's prepared to do for the Kurdish people in Turkey. And so far, Erdogan and his government haven't really done anything in that regard. So, this may be a step forward in the peace process, but it comes, I think, with some indication that things could stall out at this point unless there's there's some movement from the Turkish government to do something to maybe, change laws to make, there's been talk of raising the profile of the Kurdish language in Turkey or, things of that nature, to releasing Kurdish politicians from the prisons that they're in, maybe reducing the severity of Abdullah Öcalan's confinement. He's the leader of the Kurdistan Workers Party. He's in solitary confinement, has been there for years, kept there for years by the Turks. Maybe, easing the severity of that. But it's going to have to be something. I don't know what exactly it would look like, but it doesn't sound like the PKK is prepared to take any other steps until they see some action from the other side here.
Thank you, Derek. Let's talk about the Afghan-Pakistan ceasefire talks, which have broken down.
Right. I mean, we covered the border clashes between Afghanistan and Pakistan earlier this month. They reached a tentative ceasefire agreement in a sort of quickie emergency round of talks in Doha and Qatar. That was supposed to be followed up, I should say, by more substantive negotiations on a more durable ceasefire in Istanbul that took place over the weekend and were then extended into Monday and I believe Tuesday as well, after they failed to produce any sort of positive outcome over the weekend. They broke up on Tuesday with the Pakistanis leaving, blaming the Afghan delegation for refusing to make any concessions. So they have failed. There's a report floating around was floating around Thursday morning that they may have restarted the talks. I don't know the details around that. But basically, the sticking point here appears to be the presence of Pakistani Taliban militants in Afghanistan, which is the reason why the border conflict started in the first place. The Pakistani military started conducting airstrikes in, like Kabul, really serious stuff to try and take out Pakistani Taliban personnel or leadership. The Pakistanis want the Afghan government to stop the Pakistani Taliban from carrying out attacks across the border in Pakistan. The Afghan government says it doesn't have any control over the Pakistani Taliban and says that's an internal issue for Pakistan to deal with. It's not their problem. Nevertheless, it is the case that Pakistani Taliban leaders and members are in Afghanistan and do cross the border to attack Pakistan. The question of whether the Afghan government's going to actually do anything to interdict those sort of looms is the big question looming over these negotiations. And so far, as I say, they haven't made any progress, but they may be back at the table at this point.
We've all done it. Stock our fridge with good intentions, only to have our future self sacrifice nutrition for convenience. Keep your body and mind nourished with whole body meal shakes from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But it actually tastes delicious. Try one of Kachava's indulgent flavors today. Your future self will thank you. Go to kachava.com and use code HEALTH for 15% off your next order. That's Kachava, KACHAVA.com, code HEALTH.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Myanmar, where a rebel group has agreed to a ceasefire. This is really the ceasefire section of our weekly news roundup.
Yes.
Jake, you should make music.
We're moving into the election section in a moment, but this is the ceasefire block. The Tang National Liberation Army, which is one of the major rebel factions in Myanmar, operates in Shan State in the northern part of the country, reached a ceasefire and announced it on Wednesday with Myanmar's ruling junta. This comes after the TNLA has lost a number of towns, a number of significant commercial towns to the military. The military is working with, I think we may have talked about this either last week or the week before, with the strong support at this point of the Chinese government, which is sending, more weapons, drones, et cetera, to support the junta. So it's benefiting from that. The Chinese government also mediated these talks and probably put some pressure on the TNLA to knuckle under and agree to a ceasefire. As part of the ceasefire, the rebels agreed to withdraw from the town of Mogok, which is a hub for Myanmar's ruby mining industry, as well as another town nearby. There's no timetable, as far as I know, for when that's supposed to happen. But with the junta planning to hold what I think we could charitably call the facsimile of an election in December to pretend to be moving it to back into civilian rule, it's looking to take back as many major population centers as it can from the rebels so that it can hold that contest or that, farce of a contest, depending on your perspective, in as many towns and cities as possible. So every place it can get the rebels to withdraw from, or that it can take back militarily, is important to that effort. It's unclear, what beyond that withdrawal is involved here. I mean, ceasefire obviously suggests that they're going to stop, stop battling one another. The TNLA was already coming off the worst. Coming off worse in those engagements of late, after a really stunning string of successes over the last couple of years. The tide has definitely turned in that struggle. So, this may not be a bad thing from the rebels' perspective if it means the military is going to stop, advancing on TNLA positions.
Now we're in the election section. Yeah, we really need music for this. Jake, stop being so lazy and make some goddamn music.
There you go.
Let's start with Ivory Coast and Cameroon.
So the longtime incumbents in both of those countries have won re-election. I know everybody will be thrilled to hear that. The Ivory Coast had its presidential election on Saturday. Cameroon had its weeks ago. But we can talk about Ivory Coast first. Alassane Ouattara, the incumbent, 83-year-old, now serving the fourth of his constitutionally limited two terms, won with a very simple and believable 89.77% of the vote. Obviously everything was above board there. There have been concerns, shall we say, about this election because Ouattara, heading into it, banned basically any prominent opposition party or opposition leader from participating. And so he was facing a relatively weak field. He was, expected to trounce that field. And yet, and he did, but there are echoes here, I think, of some past events involving let's say West African leaders in particular, who have done some, pulled some constitutional shenanigans. And this is Ouattara's claim, is that, when the country adopted a new constitution in, I believe, 2016, that reset his term counter from 2 to 0. And so he was allowed to run for 2 more terms. There's an echo here in particular of what happened in Guinea, back in 2020 and 2021, Alpha Condé, who was the president at the time, won a third term of what is supposed to be 2 terms, again, claiming that a constitutional change had sort of reset the counter and he was allowed to run again. Within a year, he had been ousted in a military coup, after protests and opposition to the election. There seem to be some echoes of that. Obviously, these are 2 different countries with 2 different sets of circumstances, but there are some patterns here that suggest that things could get pretty dicey in Ivory Coast over the next, coming months or years as Ouattara maintains his hold on power despite his advanced age and legal, the legal dubiousness of the whole thing. I should say Cameroon as well. Sorry, I meant to talk about Cameroon. I forgot. Paul Biya, who is
the
oldest
again.
Yes, the oldest head of state in the world. He's in his 90s, won his 8th term
in
office.
He was just a kid.
Yeah, he's still learning the ropes, really. He won his re-election to his 8th term in office with 53.7% of the vote. There have been mass protests in several cities in Cameroon since the official results were announced. The main opposition candidate, Issa Chiroma, who had claimed victory like a day after the election when he couldn't possibly have known whether he won or not, but he was trying to create a narrative that Biya was rigging the vote count. His supporters have been mainly involved in these protests, and he's sort of questioning the official results. But, you know, this is, again, you know, a long time incumbent. I think the chances of serious upheaval in Cameroon are less just because Biya has been around the block, let's say, for a long time. But, you know, certainly something to watch as well.
On to Nigeria.
Yes, on to Nigeria, where, you know, in this case, you know, while we're on the subject of possible coups, Bola Tinubu, the president of Nigeria, fired all basically of his top military brass, or almost all of his top military brass, last week. He fired his chief, the chief of staff, the equivalent of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the U.S. He fired the chief of staff of the Nigerian Navy and the Nigerian Air Force. This is all coming amid speculation, and I think there's some fairly compelling evidence that the speculation is correct, that there has been a coup plot brewing within the Nigerian military for some time now. There were reports last month or early this month of the arrest of a large number of military officers that were, you know, kind of sketchily talked about in Nigerian media. But since then, as I say, speculation has been rife that these people were caught out in some kind of plot to overthrow Tinubu. And that would, you know, have been the cause for turning over the top brass, again, almost entirely of the Nigerian military. It's still seems unlikely. Nigeria is a fairly professionalized military, relatively speaking. It seems unlikely that a coup is going to, that they're actually going to be able to pull off a coup against Tinubu, or that this is something that would gain widespread traction within the military. It may, and Alex Thurston, we've had on the program before, wrote about this in his newsletter, may have some, if there is a coup plot in the works, or if a coup does take place, it may get some popular traction with the Nigerian public. Tinubu is not terribly popular at this point. It doesn't seem like he hasn't been very successful at addressing the economic and security challenges that Nigeria is facing. He's another older gentleman. He's 73, though, which for the U.S. would make him middle-aged, U.S. politics at least. But Nigeria is a very young country, so they may be looking at this. And of course, we've seen young people, we've seen these so-called Gen Z protests around the, you know, various countries around the world in the last few months. There may be, you know, some youthful resentment of Tinubu at this point, or of his failure to address these problems. So it's possible there could be something going on here. I think it's just, you know, something that to keep an eye on. But for right now, it doesn't seem like things have advanced terribly far. And maybe Tinubu has managed to buy himself some time with all of these arrests and you know, kind of swapping people out in the top jobs.
Let's turn to some actual good news this week, which is the result of the Netherlands election, which has basically put the far right, at least it appears for the moment, on a back foot.
Yeah, there was a snap election on Wednesday, snap parliamentary election in the Netherlands on Wednesday, made necessary by the fact that the far right Party for Freedom, a friend of the pod, Geert Wilders, pulled out of the country's governing coalition earlier this year when they wouldn't agree to his various ideas for brutalizing migrants. The other parties wouldn't agree to those things. And so in a huff, he kind of, you know, yanked his party out and forced this snap election. They have not done terribly well. Party for Freedom has not done terribly well. It did finish or it looks like with almost all the votes counted, it finished in a tie for first place with a somewhat surprising finisher, the sort of centrist, maybe center left, if you squint at it the right way, Democrats 66 or D66 party. Both of them look like they project to have 26 seats in the Chamber of Deputies in the coming session. But for PVV, that is a huge loss. That's 11 seats. That's a net loss of 11 seats over their performance in the 2023 election. And it's not enough to put Wilders back in the conversation in terms of participating in a governing coalition. Almost all of the other major parties at this point, after his, you know, the shenanigans that he pulled with the last government, have expressed a strong desire not to work with him again in forming a new government. And so this probably puts PVV on the outside looking in. On the other hand, it makes the leader of the D66 party, Ron Yeten, it puts him on track to become the youngest prime minister in Dutch history. He's 38 years old. I get the sense he's riding a sort of Barack Obama-esque wave in that he's young, he's charismatic. People seem to like him when they hear him speak or when they see him on TV. And that seems to have been partly responsible for the surge that D66 saw in its polling toward the end, you know, as the election was approaching, and then obviously, you know, doing well enough to wind up tied for the largest party in parliament. It does put the far right on the back foot. It means they're not going to be involved in this next government. It suggests that maybe, you know, the exposure to Wilders and the far right turned off a number of Dutch voters, you know, having them in government as opposed to being on the sidelines in the opposition, kind of, you know, throwing hand grenades at everybody, actually having them in a position of responsibility turn people off and watching the way that they operated. But, you know, it's hard to draw any conclusions. And who knows, you know, if this government, once it gets formed, and it's probably going to take months, because all Dutch coalition negotiations seem to take months after every election. So it'll probably take months to form the next government. And if it's not stable enough to survive, we could see Wilders and PVV back in the lead position in the next election.
Well, Derek, things aren't going so great with our neighbor to the north. Let's talk about U.S.-Canada relations. Let's talk about Trump cutting off trade talks and raising tariffs.
Trump is angry over an ad that the Ontario provincial government cut and released in U.S. markets, I think during the World Series. That may be how he saw it. That uses a 1987 presidential radio address by Ronald Reagan, then president of the United States, on the issue of free and fair trade, where he denounces tariffs. And, you know, the point is obviously, you know, Trump is loves tariffs and tariffs are bad. And here's this other, you know, arch conservative U.S. president here to tell you that tariffs are bad and that the U.S. shouldn't be pursuing them and that Trump is wrong. Trump was very angry about this ad. The Ronald Reagan Foundation was also very, you know, presidential foundation, I guess his library basically, was also very angry about this ad. They accused the Ontario government of misrepresenting Reagan's words, and so they were reviewing their legal options. I'm not sure what those might be. It's not clear how they misrepresented Reagan's words. They did take sound bites from the speech and play them kind of out of order during the ad, but the overall thrust of the address back in 1987 was that Reagan didn't agree with tariffs. He was a free trade guy. And so the message of the ad seems pretty consistent with where Reagan stood on this stuff. Nevertheless, we're all quite mad about this. And as you said, Donald Trump announced that he was cutting off trade talks with the Canadian government. He then announced this late last week, and then within a couple of days announced that he was raising tariffs on Canadian products by another 10%. The actual effect of that is unclear, because most Canadian exports to the U.S. are governed under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the successor to NAFTA, and can't, you know, they're tariff exempt under that agreement. So he's not going to be able to tariff that much. Nevertheless, yeah, the state of U.S.-Canadian relations is back to being somewhat poor, I guess. And Mark Carney went off to Asia again to participate in the two big summits that we mentioned earlier, and was probably there looking for new trade partners or to expand Canada's trade relationships with countries in the region to account for the fact that the U.S. is no longer a reliable commercial partner for Canada.
Speaking of trade, let's talk about the U.N. General Assembly voting on the Cuba embargo.
Yeah, it was a huge diplomatic victory for the United States, I think. On Wednesday, the UN General Assembly had its annual vote to condemn the U.S. embargo on Cuba. And The Trump administration got six whole other countries to vote no along with it, to vote down the resolution or vote against the resolution, which is really, really great work by everybody concerned. Of course, there were 165 countries that voted it to condemn the embargo. Only six that voted not to condemn it. The six were Argentina, or seven, I guess, with the U.S. Argentina, Hungary, Israel, North Macedonia, Paraguay, and Ukraine all joined the U.S. in voting no, which doesn't seem like much, but is a lot better than they did last year when it was just the U.S. and Israel voting no and everybody else voting either yes or abstaining. So, yeah, big, big movement here. Obviously, the resolution is meaningless. The UN General Assembly does this every year. It never actually changes the embargo. The UN General Assembly has no, any of its votes. The resolutions that it passes are not binding. It's purely symbolic. But, the symbolism is still there.
I believe it was friend of the pod, Richard Nixon, who referred to it as a damned debating society, if I remember
pretty
correctly.
Much, yeah.
I am not double-checking that one.
You can't let the little people have a say, right? It's got to be the Security Council and really the five permanent members of the Security Council that dictate policy to the rest of the world. And everybody else just kind of there is there to vent and blow off steam, but they're not really supposed to make decisions.
As it should be. Let's talk about the continued bombing of boats near Venezuela and what you think is going on with that, Derek.
So there's a couple of things to say here. I mean, the U.S. has expanded its bombing campaign to the Eastern Pacific now. Where exactly in the Eastern Pacific is unclear. Many of the strikes, it's undertaken several at this point. Many of them seem to be happening close to Colombia, although there was at least one that took place this week where there was spotters detected a survivor in the wreckage of the boat that the U.S. military had bombed and notified the Mexican government to carry out a potential rescue mission. And the Mexican government said it was searching an area southwest of Acapulco, which is nowhere near Colombia. So who knows exactly where, these could be taking place all over the Eastern Pacific. For all I know, the U.S. military hasn't been terribly forthcoming with details, but they have carried out now as of when we're recording this, and this will maybe change by the time people listen to it. They've blown up 14 boats allegedly carrying drugs and drug traffickers. They've murdered or summarily executed, would take your pick, 61 people at least in these attacks without, really bothering with any legal justification. Even Republicans in Congress seem to be getting antsy about, I think they just got a briefing from the administration about the strikes and sort of trying to lay out some legal framework, but they had been getting antsy about the legality of some of this stuff. Reuters even reported that members of the U.S. military personnel who have been assigned to this particular campaign are being made to sign non-disclosure agreements, which is really unusual for the Pentagon. Most things are already governed by secrecy designations. So asking them to sign NDAs, I can't explain that, but I get the sense it's not a good thing that they're being asked to do that. So a lot of things to be wary of here. I will also say, as Trump continues to threaten to take this campaign onto land, which really means, bombing Venezuela, maybe bombing Colombia too, now that Trump and Gustavo Petro are really, really at one another. And the U.S. has even designated Petro for sanctions late last week. There may be some strikes that take place in Colombia, for all I know. But he keeps threatening to sort of move this onto land. The U.S. military announced that it was deploying the Gerald R. Ford, an aircraft carrier, and its carrier group to the Southern Caribbean. It's going to take still, I think, a few days for those vessels to arrive in the region, but that will substantially increase the level of force that the U.S. has in the region, far beyond anything that would make sense for a so-called counter-narcotics operation, which they're still pretending that this is. I think you're looking at more intensive action, either to weaken unfriendly leaders, and again, probably focused primarily on Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, but maybe also, taking a couple of shots at Petro in Colombia. I think you're going to see more intensive efforts in that regard once the Ford shows up, because this is really getting somewhat ridiculous for a, you know, an anti-drugs operation to have that much military force that close to those countries.
Well, Derek, in good news, we are inching ever closer to nuclear Armageddon, and the whole thing might just finally end. Let's talk about...
You know, blessed release.
Let's talk about Trump restarting, question mark, nuclear testing.
Yeah, so he made this kind of off-the-cuff announcement after his meeting with Xi in South Korea on Thursday that basically he's going to order the U.S. military to resume nuclear testing. Oh, okay. He said that this would put the U.S. on an equal basis with other countries that are testing nukes. It's unclear which other countries are testing nukes. I mean, North Korea has certainly tested nukes in recent years, but it hasn't done so for quite some time. It's focused more on its missile program. The implication, I think, was that Russia and China have been testing nuclear weapons, or Russia and or China have been testing nuclear weapons, but there's no evidence of any of that. The Russian military did recently carry out another test, and it's you know, done a couple of these of what it calls a nuclear powered missile, which is not, does not have a nuclear warhead necessarily attached to it, although obviously you would probably be inclined to put one on it. But this is a sort of cruise missile type, I think, or you know, maybe ballistic missile type that's powered by a mini nuclear reactor. It all sounds kind of absurd, but the point is that you can fire these things and they can stay in the air almost indefinitely, just kind of circling the earth until you see an opening in an enemy's air defenses, or you kind of wait them out and then you can, you know, direct it onto target. So it's supposed to evade, supposed to be able to evade basically any air defense system. Maybe Trump was referring to that, although again, that's not, technically speaking, it's a missile test. It's not a nuclear weapons test. I guess if you look at it the right way, you could say, well, come on, you know, it's still got a nuclear power source on board, maybe. But that's pretty thin. I mean, that you're stretching things pretty far to use that as a justification for abandoning the comprehensive test ban treaty, you know, which has been in place for decades. The U.S. never ratified it, but has been observing it. And all other countries that possess nuclear weapons, except North Korea, also observe it. So, you know, to tear that up and send us back to the days of, you know, White Sands or whatever, and like, you know, or blowing up nuclear weapons on some atoll in the Pacific to the great detriment of the people who live in the vicinity. You know, that seems pretty thin stuff to base that on. Nevertheless, we may be at that point. So exciting. Yeah, exciting stuff coming in the future, I guess.
Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. Again, a call to support the show if you can. We really do appreciate all of our beautiful subscribers, and we couldn't do it without you. Derek, I don't know if you know, the Discord has been really popping off. A bunch of people have joined in the last week or so. So if you're interested in that, check out our Discord. And thank you all for listening. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.